This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Witch's Touch, A Seven Kingdoms Tale 3, by S. E. Smith. Narrated by David Brennan. Prologue.
"I can't," the old man mumbled, shaking his head in distress. "My magic will not work against the queen. We are bound... No, no. The queen is too powerful."
"Ore," the queen called from the doorway of their private study. The king of the Isle of Magic looked up from where he was sitting behind the beautifully carved wood desk. His eyes were glazed with an ink-black film. With a frown, the queen stepped into the darkened room. She waved her hand, and the blinds slid back. Ore rose from his seat with an animalistic snarl. The queen's hand froze in mid-air at the uncharacteristic sound.
"Isha?"
the queen quietly called, never taking her eyes off of her husband. She saw only a reflection of herself in his black eyes, not the warm, loving, and compassionate man who had once inhabited his body.
"I see it, Your Majesty,"
Isha quietly responded. Ore reached down and picked up the black box he had been talking to. Clutching the small rectangular case between his gnarled hands, he pushed the chair back and stepped into the shadows. His hands shook as the power inside the container began to surge, hungry for Magicka and Isha's magic. He knew what they were looking at, the box, his box. They wanted to take it from him and destroy it. He would have given them the box if he could. But the dark magic that was wrapped around him made it impossible to surrender the small container. Instead, he protectively cradled it against his body.
"I command you to leave,"
Ore ordered in a trembling voice.
"Ore, you're ill. Give me the box, and I will take you back to our living quarters to rest,"
Magicka requested in a gentle tone, stepping further into the room.
"This is not for you. It is my gift. No one else can have it,"
Ore replied.
"When did she return it to you, Ore? The Sea Witch is banned from the Isle of Magic. You know that. You promised you would tell me if she returned. Please, husband, give the container to me. I miss who you were. Whatever unnatural magic is in the box, it is killing you,"
Magicka said, continuing to walk toward him. Ore trembled. He wanted to give in to his wife's request. He missed her soft touch, the laughter in her voice, the love they felt for each other. She completed him.
"No, she is trying to trick you,"
a voice hissed in his head.
"Our love,"
Ore started to argue, before wincing at the intense pain that shot through his body,
"is an illusion. They are trying to destroy you. It is time. Call the Sea Witch,"
the voice commanded.
"We will stop the deceit of the queen and her followers."
"Please, Ore,"
Magicka pleaded, stopping less than a foot from him. Ore blinked at his wife, bringing her face into focus as he automatically reached out to her when she extended her hand toward him. His lips parted on a hiss, and he stumbled back several steps. Ore stopped when he hit the bookshelf behind him.
"Sea Witch, it has commanded me to call you,"
Ore said with a shudder. He bowed his head, struggling to hold on to the last of his sanity.
"Magicka, you must escape. It is too late. I cannot fight it any longer."
Magicka stepped back in shock when the small box in his hands began to dissolve into a dark mist that swirled around him. Ore lifted his head to gaze at his wife in agony. His fight to keep the creature from attaching itself to his magic was draining him. His gaze moved to the young warrior who came up behind Magicka.
"It is too late. I can only hope to contain him long enough for you to get our queen to safety,"
Ore forced out, past the blackness wrapped around his throat.
"No!"
Magicka cried, reaching out again for her husband.
You must escape, Your Majesty, Isho ordered, pulling her behind him. By the magic of my sword, you will release the king. Isho swung his glowing sword at the black mist, but Ore knew it was already too late. The box in his hand had changed, and was reforming into a ghostly creature determined to enslave him. Tentacles of black clashed with Isha's sword. Golden sparks glowed before the magic contained in Isha's sword sizzled and hissed. The black essence greedily absorbed the additional magic. Ore could feel the Sea Witch's connection with the alien life form. Deep down, he was amazed that the young girl, who he had known since she was born, had been able to fight against the evil force contained within the black essence. The link he had with it allowed him to see what had happened to Magna. The parallels to his own situation were terrifying. She had been overpowered, the same as he had been, and she was still there, trapped within it. Yet he could still feel the essence of the young girl hidden beneath the layers, hiding, seeking her freedom. As hard as he had fought to understand, to resist, and to contain the malevolent life form, it had still sucked him into its suffocating grasp.
Heart as cold as ice, keep my soul safe behind its frozen wall. I command you to seal me now,
Ore whispered the spell in a tortured voice.
Ore, no,
Magicka cried, struggling to get to her husband. Magicka's grief-stricken cry pierced him for a moment before the spell took effect. Ore knew the only way to protect his kingdom, and what was left of him, was to cast a spell that only his queen or the death of the entity could one day free him from. A dusting of ice formed over his skin, turning it a light blue color. He exhaled small puffs of warm breath before white crystals formed. Inside, the blood in his veins slowed until even it no longer flowed. He was alive, yet not. His body was stiff, moving like a puppet on a string, handled by an inexperienced puppeteer when pushed by the evil mass flowing around him. The emotions from his last second of awareness were frozen on his face. The last thing he would remember would be Magicka's distraught face. Ore was unaware of what happened next. In his frozen world, he was of no use to the creature. Nothing could touch him or control him now. Not even the anguished cries of his beloved could penetrate the ice protecting his soul.
Your Majesty, escape!
Isha shouted as he swung his spelled sword at the swirling bands. He was forced to retreat when the black mass solidified and formed into a half-dozen deadly sharp points. He sliced through three of them. His blade sparked as it passed through the mass that dissolved and reformed. He clenched the sword's hilt with both hands, trying different spells and striking again and again in an effort to find out what would temporarily stop the beast. Behind him, he heard the queen utter a powerful spell. Veins made of diamonds rose from the floor. The long tubular coils twisted and turned, creating a cage around the creature. Isha turned when he saw, out of the corner of his eye, a movement near the window. From the shadows, Magna appeared, dressed in a gown of blood red, with her black hair flowing around her as if caught in gale-force winds. She stepped out of a swirling dark mist. Isha continued his retreat. Behind him, he could hear the queen's footsteps as she fled to warn the other guards. He could already see thin cracks appearing in the diamond prison the queen had formed around the creature. Reaching out, he gripped the handle of the door with one hand and held his sword pointed toward Magna with the other. His gaze swept over the Sea Witch's face. Her skin was pale as moonlight, and her dark eyes held a haunted expression that looked too large for her gaunt face. Her lips were the color of a moonless night and slightly parted. She stared at him with unblinking eyes the color of ink.
"The time has come for the magic held within the isle to belong to us," she said, in a voice that echoed strangely in the room.
Isha's hand tightened on the sword.
"I will see you buried in the darkest regions of the ocean before the Isle of Magic will ever belong to you, Sea Witch,"
Isha snarled in an icy tone. Closing the door and locking it with a strong spell, he wrapped both hands around his sword. With a shout, he poured every ounce of his magic into the sword. Lifting it, he charged Magna. She stood still, as if waiting for his blade to pierce her. The diamond walls exploded, creating a deafening noise. Isha felt the pain from the diamond shards as they struck him, but ignored it. Slicing his sword through the air, he caught his breath when the end of the sharp blade was stopped by a thick black tentacle less than an inch from Magna's delicate neck. Isha cried in pain when another deadly band wrapped around his waist. The band lifted him off his feet while other bands encircled his arms and legs. His sword, still glowing with his magic, fell from his numb fingers. He struggled, but the bands gripping him felt like a giant's fist squeezing his body until he was sure his bones would snap. Gasping for air, he watched Magna step forward and bend to pick up his sword. Isha tried to withdraw his magic from it, but the blackness was draining him. He slowly curled the fingers of his right hand in frustration.
"Magna!" he gasped. "You have no idea of the power we are dealing with, Isha," Magna informed him.
Isha blinked when Magna lifted his sword. He opened his fingers to prepare for her strike, but he was, instead, shocked when she placed the sword in his hand. Darkness blurred the edge of his vision as a serene smile appeared on her face.
"Sleep, warrior," Magna murmured.
Isha's lips parted on a gasp. He could feel the spell burning through his body like a flash fire. His features hardened until he was no longer a living, breathing entity, but a stone statue in the image of the great warrior that he once was. Marina Fay kicked at a pebble along her path and watched it bounce until it rolled to a stop against the vine-covered walls of the palace. Shouldering her bow, a mischievous grin lit her face. She glanced around before lifting her arms up and wiggling her fingers. The vines hanging down from the tree on the other side of the wall spiraled down and wrapped around her wrists. A moment later, she was lowered to the ground on the other side of the wall. Turning to face the tree, she did a brief curtsy.
"Thank you, Mr. Tree," she laughed.
She turned and started cutting through the large garden surrounding the palace. Technically, she should have gone through the front gates, but she never did. One advantage of being the younger sister of the captain of the guard, everyone knew who she was. Humming under her breath, she gripped her bow and took off at a slight jog along the winding path that cut through the huge garden maze. She was excited. Isha was supposed to return to their village today. She would surprise him at the palace, and just make sure he hadn't forgotten that he said he'd be home. The annual Festival of Lights this weekend was a very special time in their village. Because the village was farther inland than the palace, which was closer to the sea, the mountains came alive once a year with the blooming of the night star flowers. The blossoms would open, and the glowing seeds within would float up into the trees, lighting the forest with color. The villagers' voices would rise in song and spread their magic on the breeze to mix with the floating seeds. It truly was a magical night, and one that she loved to witness. Marina's steps slowed when she heard the sound of shouting and a scream that was cut short. She stumbled when the ground shook under her feet from a loud explosion that ripped through the air. To steady herself, she reached out and wrapped her left hand around the thick branch of one of the tall bushes that hedged the maze. She was almost to the exit near the main gardens to the right of the palace's front entrance. Releasing the branch, she whispered to her bow. She could feel the string grow taut as she woke the magic within the bow. She moved forward in concern when she heard the queen's voice rise above the shouts, cries, and screams. A feeling of concern flooded Marina. She couldn't help thinking in an oddly disconnected way that she had never heard the queen's voice raised in anger before. She had only taken a few steps forward when she caught her breath in surprise. Thick bands of magic swirled around her like a turbulent river, rushing toward the area where she had heard the queen's voice. The pure beauty and power of the flowing colors took Marina's breath away. Spying the exit from the maze, Marina put on a burst of speed. She slid to a stop when she cleared the last hedge. Her lips parted in horrified awe. On the front steps of the palace stood a slender woman. All around her, a dark mist twisted and churned. The woman looked as if she was made of the black essence.
"Sea witch," Marina whispered, her gaze glued to Magna.
"I command you to stop, Magna! As queen of the Isle of Magic, I sentence you to death for your deceit and traitorous acts,"
Magicka declared, lifting her hands.
"You cannot stop me. I now control the Isle of Magic and all the powers of this kingdom," Magna replied, her voice strangely flat. "You are wrong, Magna. Whatever evil magic you have summoned, it is not from this world. Think of the damage you're doing,"
Magicka responded in a cold voice.
"Magna!"
Marina turned to see Kel and Selene, Magna's parents, appear. The queen must have summoned them. Hope rushed through Marina. Surely the pleas of the sea witch's parents would be able to touch their daughter.
"Think of your family, Magna," the queen said.
Marina's gaze anxiously turned back to the queen. A soft hiss slipped from her lips when she realized what the queen was doing. Queen Magicka was weaving a spell in her words and using Magna's parents to distract the sea witch. Marina had never seen such pure and beautiful magic woven so tightly, so precisely. The ability to see magic was one of her talents. She had inherited her gift from her grandmother, who had cautioned her to keep the ability to herself.
"No one else has the gift like you and I, Marina,"
her grandmother told her when she was barely 10 years old.
"Except perhaps the queen and king. There isn't much use for the ability to see magic, except when you need to. Keep this little secret. You never know when it might come in handy,"
her grandmother had added with a wink. Now she watched the threads reaching out toward Magna. The magic was subtle, woven in the words the queen spoke. Marina turned to focus her attention on Magna again. Was Magna able to see the magic? How would she react toward her parents? Marina's mouth dropped open when the black essence surrounding Magna reached greedily for the hidden strands of magic. The queen cried out in pain as the bands devoured the magical threads. Marina could see the malevolent mist greedily absorbing the queen's magic and growing stronger.
"Magna, no!"
Kel shouted, stepping forward and placing himself between the queen and his daughter.
"Let us help you. Please, I beg of you, give yourself up, and we will help you."
The expression on Magna's face softened, her lips parted, and for a moment Marina thought the sea witch would give in. Even from several yards away, Marina could see the conflict on the other woman's face. The indecision lasted no more than a second before her expression hardened.
"Watch out!"
Marina cried, lifting her hand in warning. She saw the change in the mist. In horror, she helplessly watched as two long tentacles shot out. The bands wrapped around Kel. Magna's mother, Selene, lifted her glowing hands while her lips moved, weaving a deadly spell to stop her daughter's attack. A wave of mist swept over Selene, hardening her features to stone and freezing the incomplete spell on her lips. Magic unlike anything Marina had ever seen before rose up around those standing in the courtyard. All around her, the features of the queen's guards and the few servants who had fled outside began to freeze and hardened. Even Queen Magicka was not immune to the horrifying mist turning her people to stone. Marina frantically swept her gaze across the sea of faces, searching for her brother. She needed to find him. Surely Isha could feel the danger to the queen and would come to her assistance. Unless, she thought with a growing panic, he was protecting the king.
"Mr. Boo, I need arrows,"
Marina ordered, lifting the bow in her hand and drawing the bowstring.
Isha! The queen cried, fighting to keep the black mist from enveloping her.
He is lost to you, my queen, just as everyone who resists me will be,
the sea witch informed her, slowly descending the steps.
What magic is this?
Magicka demanded, her voice shaken as the circle around her grew smaller and smaller.
It isn't magic. It is something far more powerful, more deadly, more horrifying than anything magic could create,
Magna replied, in a voice that barely carried on the wind. Marina's fingers trembled, and she lowered the bow in her hand. Her eyes widened as pain and grief swept through her. Behind Magna, Marina saw a man appear. He walked with stiff, jerky movements. His face, shimmering with a film of ice in the light, was devoid of all emotion, as if his body was there, but that was all. Behind the king, the perfectly carved stone statue of her brother, Isha, his magical sword still firmly held in his hand, floated past the king on a wave of the black mist. Marina released a broken cry of denial. The queen's anguished cry mixed with Marina's. Rage pierced the bubble of horror that surrounded her, and her jaw tightened in determination. Lifting her bow, she didn't hesitate this time. She released the magical arrow. The fire burning through her veins increased when she saw the black bands swirling around Magna rise up to devour her arrow. Marina's eyes narrowed, and she hissed out in fury. Reaching over her shoulder, she pulled an arrow from her quiver. If the creature fed on magic, she would see how it liked non-magical elements. Knocking the arrow, she pulled the bowstring back and whispered to her bow.
"Let my aim be true, Mr. Bow," she murmured.
Her fingers parted, releasing the string. The arrow flew through the air. The black bands reached greedily for the wooden shaft, but the arrow curved, dodging the tentacles that were trying to stop it. Magna turned at the last second, the tip of the arrow cutting a thin, deep cut along the bicep of her left arm. Queen Magicka turned and saw her.
"Marina, you have to warn the kingdom,"
Magicka cried out seconds before the dark mist covered her, and her body grew stiff.
"Stop her!"
Magna snarled, grasping her injured arm with her other hand. Marina lurched back several steps when the dark mass began to take shape. Massive creatures grew and solidified out of the bands. Their eyes glowed an eerie red, while long, shiny black fangs lengthened from their upper jaws. The black beasts had long snouts with a series of ridges that stopped between their eyes. Stiff spines rose from the top of their skulls and ran the length of their back down to their long, whip-like tails. Their four legs, each with massive paws and sharp claws, dug into the soft, grassy areas of the garden, which was littered with the petrified bodies of the palace's soldiers, servants, and the queen. Marina stumbled back toward the entrance to the maze, drawing another arrow from her quiver. Her hands remained steady, even as she drew an uneven breath. These were not creatures of any magic she had ever seen before. Her mind flashed back to what the queen had said to Magna.
"It is not from this world. Think of the damage."
Lifting her chin, she pulled the bowstring back and breathed deeply when the beast closest to her snarled and took a step forward.
"Let's see if you're real," she said.
She whispered a spell. A dark blue film coated the tip of her arrow. Opening her fingers, she released the string as the beast leaped forward. Marina didn't wait to see if the arrow did its work or not. She turned and fled back into the maze.
Chapter 1. Yahats, Oregon.
"Mike, you have company,"
Patty called from the reception area. Mike grimaced and wiped at the damp stain on his shirt where he'd spilled his coffee. It was going to be one of those days. He could feel it. It started out with his sister, Ruth, calling at an ungodly hour to inform him that she would be coming by for a visit. He could thank his birthday for that wonderful occasion.
"Just a minute,"
Mike answered, dropping the file folder on his desk.
He placed the cup of coffee he had picked up at the cafe down the street on a folded paper towel that showed the evidence of his spillage from the days before. Hell, who was he kidding? The whole week had been one mishap after another. With a shake of his head, he grabbed a crumpled napkin from the bag of bagels he had added to his order at the last minute.
"I got you and everything, bagel," Mike grunted, not looking up when he heard the footsteps stop outside the door.
"Thank you, but I've already eaten," an unfamiliar voice replied.
"Oh, hey, Mike, did you remember the cream cheese this time?" Patty asked, peering around the slender Asian man, watching him with a slightly amused expression.
"Yeah, I got extra," Mike replied, absently wiping at the wet spot on his dark blue dress shirt.
"Can I help you?"
Mike ran his gaze over the man, quickly picking out and storing details. Early 30s, approximately 5 feet 10 inches, brown eyes, thin scar near his left eye. The creases pressed into his dress slacks, the polished black shoes, and the precision cut of his hair indicated he was military or former military. The man's gaze was taking in everything about Mike and his office, and Mike figured that made him military intelligence.
"Yes," came the short reply.
"I forgot your cappuccino, Patty. Why don't you go get it? I'll cover the phones," Mike suggested, holding out the bag with the bagels in it.
"Are you sure?" Patty asked, briefly glancing at the man who had stepped aside to allow her to enter. Mike's lips twitched when Patty jerked her eyes as if trying to convey a secret message to him.
"I'm sure," he replied, in a dry tone.
"Oh, okay. Well, I won't be but a few minutes. If you need me, just call," Patty said, clutching the bag to her chest and turning to look up at their guest. "The cafe is, like, right next door. The walls are thin. Really thin. As in, tissue paper thin, if you know what I mean."
"Patty, go,"
Mike ordered in exasperation.
"Jeez, I'm going," Patty muttered.
Mike remained standing until he heard the bell on the front door chime before he waved a hand to the seat across from him. He waited for the man to sit down before he took his seat. Gathering up the photographs that had spilled out of the file folder he dropped earlier, he tucked them back in and set it aside before sitting back in his chair.
"Now, what can I do for you, Mr.?" Mike began.
"Tanaka, Agent Asahi Tanaka, CIA," Asahi replied, reaching into the inside pocket of his jacket and pulling out his identification. Mike leaned forward and took the slim leather wallet. Opening it, he scanned the credentials inside, before closing the wallet and handing it back.
Asahi returned the wallet to his pocket. "So what brings the CIA to Yahats, Oregon?" Mike asked.
"The file you have on your desk, Detective Holbrook," Asahi replied. Mike's gaze immediately went to the creased, coffee-stained folder. He needed to replace it. He'd been carrying this one around so much that it was almost worn out. He pressed his lips together and looked up at the man sitting across from him.
"What does the disappearance of two women have to do with the CIA?" Mike asked, clasping his hands together and forming a steeple with his two index fingers. "I could understand the FBI, but the CIA? That is pushing it, unless you think that Carly Tate and Jenny Ackerley were spies working for a foreign government."
Asahi's gaze moved from Mike to the file and back again. His lips pursed together for a moment before he relaxed and his expression became unreadable. Mike had no doubt that this man spent more time out in the field than pushing papers.
"I'm not at liberty to explain, but yes, there is an interest in their disappearance," Asahi said, with a slight bow of his head.
Mike leaned forward, resting his arms on his desk. A frown creased his brow as he thought about what the two women could have done to bring them to the attention of the CIA. Everything and everyone he talked to made him think that Carly and Jenny were just two ordinary U.S. citizens who happened to know each other and be in the same place when they disappeared.
"If you aren't at liberty to tell me, then why are you here?" Mike sarcastically asked.
"You've been studying this case for a while," Asahi said.
"Since I took over here," Mike replied with a nod.
"Have you discovered anything unusual about their disappearance?" Asahi inquired. Mike didn't miss the way Asahi's eyes flickered to the file and back again. The man wanted to look at it. Mike could feel it in his bones.
Curious, he placed his left hand on the file and pushed it toward the agent.
"Why don't you tell me?" Mike suggested.
They locked gazes for a brief moment before Asahi reached out to take the file. Mike held the file long enough for Asahi to know that the information wouldn't come without a price. There was a brief flash of annoyance in Asahi's eyes.
"The information is need-to-know only," Asahi explained in a quiet voice.
Mike raised an eyebrow. "I need to know," he responded with a wry smile.
"How long have you lived in Yahats, Detective Holbrook?" Asahi asked, pulling the folder toward him and opening it when Mike released it and sat back in his chair again.
"A couple of years," Mike replied.
"Why?"
"Have you noticed anything unusual during the time you've lived here?"
Asahi asked, slowly thumbing the notes and documents that Mike had collected.
"Define strange," Mike said dryly. "We have our share of unusual individuals who live in the area, but no one I would classify as dangerous."
"Dangerous is not necessarily what I am searching for," Asahi replied,
pausing on a handwritten document comparing Carly and Jenny's disappearance.
"May I have a copy of this file?"
"What in the hell is going on, Agent Tanaka?" Mike demanded.
Asahi looked up at Mike. His gaze was deadly serious. Mike's stomach clenched when the man hesitated and closed the file.
"Aliens," Asahi said, at the same time as the front door chimed.
"Mike, I'm back! Did we get any phone calls? Is that weird?"
"Oh, he's still here," Patty said, stopping in the doorway. Mike rose at the same time as Asahi. They gazed at each other for a moment. Mike wondered if he'd heard the man correctly, while Asahi waited for Mike's response to his request for copies.
"I was just leaving," Asahi stated, holding out the file.
"Patty can make you a copy of the files and send them to you," Mike said,
lost in thought even as he reached for the file.
"Thank you. I will leave my information with her,"
Asahi replied, stepping around the chair.
Mike looked down at the file in his hand. He could feel his head starting to shake in disbelief.
He looked up as Asahi started to step through the door.
"Tanaka," Mike called.
Asahi turned and looked back at Mike. He studied the other man's closed expression.
"Yes."
"Are you serious?" Mike asked.
"Completely."
"Have a good day, Detective Holbrook. I'm sure we will meet again," Asahi said, before turning and leaving.
Mike stood by his desk, his gaze blindly fixed on the empty doorway. It wasn't until he noticed Patty's return that he shook his head and sank down in his chair again. He looked up when she stopped in front of the desk.
"Are you shitting me? CIA? What the hell is going on?" Patty breathed.
Mike shook his head.
"When you find out, let me know," he wryly retorted.
"Can you—"
"Yeah, he gave me his info,"
Patty said, anticipating what he was about to ask her to do. She picked up the file and shook her head in awe.
"Who would have thought there would be so much excitement in this sleepy little town?"
Mike watched Patty turn and walk out the door. He knew that half the town would know about Agent Tanaka's visit by dinner. The rest would know by morning. Rising out of his seat, Mike grabbed his coffee and stepped around the desk. It was a good thing he hadn't removed his jacket this morning.
"Patty, I'm going out for a while," he yelled, heading for the back door of the police station.
Pushing the door open, he stepped outside. The thin layer of morning fog had settled into a dense curtain. A grim smile lifted the corner of his mouth.
"No fishing today." It looked like a good day to pay a visit to someone who had lived here all their life and knew both women.
Turning left, Mike decided it would be safer to walk than drive. It would also give him time to absorb what Tanaka had said. The guy asked if he had noticed anything unusual besides the disappearance of the two women.
"Only some crazy CIA agent who thinks that aliens or monsters might actually exist," Mike muttered with a shake of his head.
Mike paused on the sidewalk outside of the bar that was popular with the locals. It was located at the entrance to one of the marinas favored by the fishermen in the area. Old trawlers lined the docks. They were a stark contrast to the newer, more expensive pleasure crafts located at the city's marina.
"Ross Galloway?" Mike asked, an old man exiting the bar.
"Inside," the man said.
"Don't drive,"
Mike warned when he smelled the beer on the old man's breath.
"Can't. Truck broke down," the man mumbled.
Mike started to groan. It wasn't even 10 o'clock in the morning yet. The curse on his lips died when he saw an old woman in a red coat step around the corner. The old man perked up and wobbled towards her. He listened as the woman lovingly chided the man before wrapping her arm around his waist. Mike watched as the two disappeared into the fog. Drawing in a deep breath and releasing it, he returned his attention to his mission. He pulled the door open and stepped into the warm interior of the bar. Even though it was early, the place had nearly a dozen people sitting around, shooting the breeze with each other, eating or playing pool. The smell of bacon made his stomach growl, reminding him that he had grabbed his coffee, but Patty had commandeered the extra bagel he purchased earlier. Glancing around the dim interior, his gaze stopped on Ross Galloway, sitting at a table near the back. Mike strode through the room, nodding to those who called out a greeting. Ross looked up from where he was sitting and scowled when he saw Mike heading his way. Ignoring the frown, Mike pulled out the chair across from Ross and sat down.
"Hey, Mike, what'll you be having?"
Dorothy asked from behind the bar.
"Two eggs over medium, bacon, hash browns, and whole wheat.
And a coffee," Mike replied, before turning his attention to Ross. Ross picked up his fork and stabbed at the scrambled eggs on his plate. Ross was about the same age as Mike, with a stocky, muscular body and dark, shaggy hair that was as wild as Ross's reputation. Mike sat back in his seat when Dorothy brought his coffee out.
"Thank you," Mike said, with an appreciative smile.
"No problem. More coffee, Ross?"
Dorothy asked. Ross grunted and pushed his cup closer to the coffee pot that Dorothy was holding. He muttered a thanks under his breath. Mike sat forward when Dorothy walked off. He cradled his coffee cup between his hands, staring at the dark brown liquid.
"I told you I didn't do anything," Ross finally said.
"I know," Mike replied. Ross lifted his head and studied Mike's face for a moment before he resumed eating his breakfast.
"So why are you here, then?" he asked, in a blunt tone.
"I was hungry," Mike replied. Ross shot him a look that told Mike he didn't believe him. Amusement swept through Mike when he thought of what Ross's expression would be like if he asked the man if he'd ever seen any aliens hanging around. As much as he wanted to dismiss Tanaka's visit as a ludicrous joke, he couldn't. The man had been far too serious.
"Here you go, hon. Do you need anything else?"
Dorothy asked, placing Mike's food on the table in front of him.
"No, this is fine. Thanks, Dorothy," Mike replied.
"I'll bring more coffee in a few. You doing okay, Ross?"
Dorothy asked.
"I'm good. Thanks, Dorothy,"
Ross said. Mike waited for Dorothy to walk away before he started eating. The food was hot and the coffee strong. Mike didn't say anything at first. He often found that silence could do two things: give a man time to think or allow the other man time to stew. As the silence grew, Mike decided Ross was a thinker, which surprised him. He honestly thought the other man was more emotional and more likely to react than think. Dorothy came by and refilled both of their cups, and both men finished eating before Mike spoke. Picking up his cup, he held it between his hands as he thought about how he should phrase his question. Each question he came up with sounded even more ridiculous than the one before.
"If you want to know something, just spit it out. That usually works," Ross suggested.
Mike looked up from his coffee to see Ross gazing at him with a wary expression.
"Have you ever noticed anything strange around here?" he asked.
Ross raised one eyebrow and had an expression that asked Mike if he was shitting him. Mike grimaced. That wasn't what he'd planned to ask at all, or at least not in those exact words.
"Well, let's see. Two women disappear. Both talked to me. The cops keep sniffing around. No, nothing strange. Why do you ask?"
Ross answered in a dry tone. Mike set his coffee cup down on the table before running a hand over his face. He couldn't blame Ross for being slightly sarcastic.
Hell, he would be too if he had been in Ross's position.
"You've lived here your whole life, right?" Mike countered, sitting forward and resting his elbows on the table.
"So?" Ross replied.
Mike gritted his teeth in frustration. "So, have you ever noticed anything strange? Weird? Possibly extraterrestrial, even? Any unexplained anomalies? Creatures or things?" he bit out.
Ross's expression changed from defiant to confused.
"Anomalies? Like Bigfoot? Or a mermaid?" he asked, with an incredulous expression.
A scowl darkened Mike's face.
"No, I'm not talking Bigfoot or mermaids. Well, maybe. Have you seen anything that may not be normal?" he snapped in a low voice.
Ross nodded and glanced around him before leaning forward. Mike's fingers tightened on his coffee cup. He shot a quick look to make sure they couldn't be overheard before he leaned closer to Ross.
"I heard about this really strange detective who was asking dumbass questions about UFOs," Ross murmured.
Mike jolted back when Ross started laughing. The flash of anger turned into a chuckle of appreciation when Ross shot him a good-natured grin. Shaking his head, he lifted his coffee and finished it off.
"Do you guys need anything else?"
Dorothy asked, coming up from behind Mike.
"Nah, tell Dennis the food was good as usual," Ross replied, pulling his wallet out of his pocket.
"You're just saying that so he doesn't kick your ass out of here,"
Dorothy teased, taking the 20 Ross was holding out.
"I'll take my bill as well, Dorothy," Mike said.
"Did you ever find out what happened to those two missing women? I have to tell you, it gives me the creeps thinking there might be a murderer on the loose around here,"
Dorothy commented.
"The cases are still open," Mike said, pulling out the money for his breakfast. "Keep the change."
"A customer after my own heart,"
Dorothy cheerfully replied with a quick grin at Ross. Ross rose from his seat and shot a pained look at Mike.
"Make the poor fisherman look bad," he said.
Dorothy shook her head.
"I've seen your boat, Ross. I almost feel guilty taking your money. Almost," she chuckled as she walked away.
"Yeah, tell me about it," Ross muttered. "Do you have anything else to ask me?"
"No, just if you see or hear about anything unusual, please let me know," Mike said, rising out of his chair.
"If I see Bigfoot, I'll point you to him. If I see a mermaid, it might take me a while to report her if she's hot," Ross chuckled.
"I'll make a note of that," Mike dryly replied.
Mike followed Ross out of the pub. The morning fog had cleared, and he blinked as his eyes adjusted to the sudden brightness. He watched Ross turn and walk down to the docks. Drawing in a deep breath, he shook his head. He automatically reached down when he felt his cell phone vibrate. Pulling it out of his back pocket, he released a groan at the message that flashed across the screen.
"Happy birthday, baby brother. I'll be there around 7 tonight. I'd love some of your homemade spaghetti, but since it's your birthday, I guess you'll have to settle for my famous peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. Love ya, Ruth."
He quickly typed a reply. The immediate response of hearts and happy faces filled up the screen. He loved his sister, but she had to be the worst cook in the world. He never did have the heart to tell her that even her peanut butter and jelly sandwiches weren't all that great. It looked like he would be making a grocery store run on the way home this afternoon. He was just about to shove his cell phone back into his pocket when it vibrated again. This time it was Patty. There was a reported break-in at one of the residences down by the cove. His plan to take a ride out to Yahat State Park today would have to wait another day. With a sigh, Mike started walking back along the sidewalk to the police station. Chapter 2 Later that night, Mike lifted the lid off the simmering pot of spaghetti sauce, picked up the spoon, and stirred. The pasta was finished, salads made, and garlic bread sliced. He glanced at the clock. 6:58. Ruth should be here any minute. Sure enough, the sound of a brisk knock on the door told him his big sister had arrived for the weekend. He placed the spoon on the counter next to the stove and turned off the burner. Pulling free the dish towel he had tucked into the waistband of his jeans, he placed it on the counter as well. A frown creased his brow when he heard Ruth knock again, this time louder than before.
"The door's unlocked,"
he called, as he exited the kitchen and headed across the living room to the front door. He gripped the doorknob, twisted it, and pulled the door open.
"Since when do you—"
"Happy birthday, baby brother,"
Ruth announced, with a huge grin.
"What the fuck?"
Mike growled, raising his arms automatically when Ruth lifted the wiggling bundle in her arms.
"Happy birthday,"
Ruth grinned, pushing past him.
"I have his bed and toys out in the back of my car. You can get them while I set the table. Oh, God, that smells so good. I'm starving."
"No, no, no, no," Mike was saying before he ended up with a tongue in his mouth.
"Did you make—" "Yes, your homemade ranch dressing. I absolutely adore you,"
Ruth said from the kitchen. Mike stood there trying to glare at his sister. It was hard to do when he had to keep moving his head to avoid the tongue trying to find a way down his throat. Tucking the golden retriever puppy under his arm, he winced when it began chewing on his finger.
"Ruth," Mike growled in frustration, "please tell me you did not buy me a dog."
Ruth peeked around the corner.
"No, I did not buy you a dog," she said with a sweet smile.
Her response stopped Mike in his tracks. He looked down at the golden body. A huge dark blue bow was attached to the puppy's collar with the words, "Happy Birthday, Baby Brother," printed on it. The puppy looked up at him with eyes the color of melted chocolate, and he could feel its tail knocking against his side.
"Then explain this,"
he demanded, absently scratching the puppy's chin.
"I didn't buy him. He was given to me, and I am giving him to you,"
Ruth stated with a serene smile.
"Semantics. I'm not one of your legal documents, damn it. You know what I meant," Mike said, walking into the kitchen.
"Where are the napkins?"
Ruth asked, opening cabinets and peering inside.
"Use paper towels. They work just as good," Mike replied in exasperation. "I don't want a dog."
Ruth paused and looked at him. Mike could feel his jaw clench and knew he was about to start grinding his teeth. She had that innocent look on her face, the one that meant she was settling in for the kill.
"He is my present to you,"
she said in a soft, calm voice.
"I know, but he is a dog. Worse, he is a puppy. Do you know what puppies do?"
he demanded.
"Yes, I know very well what puppies do. In fact, if I remember correctly, they do the same thing that rats do,"
Ruth replied. Mike cringed. Yep, she was moving in for the kill.
One mistake. He'd made one mistake 15 years ago, and now it was coming back to bite him in the ass. "You were 16. I thought you would like them," Mike grumbled.
"You gave me rats for my 16th birthday," she reminded him. "Not one, but two, a girl and a boy. Be grateful you only got one puppy, baby brother. My friend had 14 more.
"God, why do women have such long memories?" Mike groaned, turning and holding the puppy up to his face.
"You have to admit, puppies have better smelling breath," Ruth chuckled.
"He smells like cake," Mike retorted.
"Yes, well, there is a reason for that," Ruth laughed.
Mike glanced down at the puppy that was now trying to wiggle out of his arms.
"At least she gave me a boy,"
he informed the puppy, before bending over and placing him on the floor.
"This means we are even, right?"
Ruth paused and looked over her shoulder.
"Oh, hell no. Not by a long shot. You have about 32 more paybacks before I write off that nightmare," she responded.
"I think we should be even now,"
he argued, grabbing a bowl for the spaghetti sauce.
"I was able to give 12 of the baby rats away to friends and let another 10 go free. And you gave me 2 fish from my 15th birthday after Mom and Dad gave us a list of non-acceptable pets. Also, you know that this puppy is going to chew on half of my new furniture, God knows how many pairs of shoes, and leave enough puddles and poop to fertilize half of Lincoln County. I won't even mention the hazards facing my living room carpet until I get him housebroken."
"Carpet is bad for your allergies, and you were planning on replacing it anyway."
"Oh, all right. I'll think about it,"
Ruth conceded, with a dramatic sigh. I don't have any problems with allergies, Mike scowled before his expression changed.
I made the homemade ranch dressing and extra sauce for you to take home, he added, with a sly smile.
Ruth bit her lip and contemplated his bribe for a moment.
Well, I guess that is worth a few rats. Okay, we're even, she grudgingly replied.
Thank you for small miracles, Mike muttered, turning to hand Ruth the bowl of sauce. By the way, thanks for driving up for my birthday, sis.
We promised we would be there for each other, no matter how far away we live,
Ruth said, gazing up at him. Mike nodded. They had promised, after losing both of their parents, that they wouldn't forget how important family was, especially since it was just the two of them now. Mike winced and looked down at the puppy attacking his sock-covered foot.
And if there are two things that my sister is very tenacious about, it is keeping promises and never forgetting anything, he thought. I'll get the pasta, he said in a gruff voice.
And cheese,
Ruth reminded him, turning toward the table.
By the way, the reason Charlie Brown here smells like cake is because he ate the one I bought you on the way up here.
Mike paused with his hand on the refrigerator door and looked at Ruth in dismay. He shot a glance at the puppy that was now attacking the straw on the broom leaning in the corner of the kitchen before looking back at Ruth.
Please tell me you purchased a kennel for him, he said.
Ruth shook her head.
Of course not. You know how I feel about caging animals, she replied.
Great, just great, he thought with a wince,
when the broom fell with a clatter and scared the puppy, which took off towards the living room. Later that night, Mike lay in bed, staring up at the ceiling, absently scratching Charlie behind his ear. The pup didn't whine when he placed him on the folded blanket on the floor next to his side of the bed. No, the damn thing had stared at him, with huge, unblinking eyes and a soulful, lost look. He had tried rolling over so his back was to the puppy, but he could feel the pup's eyes drilling a hole between his shoulder blades. Rolling over, he had finally given up and growled for the pup to join him. Of course, it took another 10 minutes after that to make Charlie stop licking him and settle down. Mike drew in a deep breath and released it. He was tired, but his mind was buzzing with everything that he and Ruth had talked about. Mostly, he thought about how the carefully laid plans for his life had changed. It had been almost 2 years since he gave up his commission in the Air Force. He had planned to stay in and serve his 20 years before retiring to do some traveling. Somewhere in the mix, he figured he'd get married if he met the right woman, but he was in no hurry. With 8 years of service, he was almost halfway to his goal. Everything changed the night he received Ruth's urgent phone call. Their dad, a career Air Force colonel, had collapsed. Family needed family, and when their dad was diagnosed with terminal brain cancer, he had returned home. What neither he nor Ruth expected was that they would be burying both their parents within 2 weeks of each other, their father from the cancer and their mother from a stroke, less than 7 months after Mike had come home. Mike knew Ruth felt guilty about his leaving the service. The thing was, no one knew exactly how long their dad would last or that their mom would die so soon afterward. Ultimately, the decision had been his to make, and he realized afterward that it had been the right one. He had been trying to follow in their dad's footsteps, but in reality he had grown tired of the confines of the military and was ready for a change. The position at the Yahats Police Department was obtained through a friend at his mom's funeral. 2 weeks later, he and Ruth had finished packing up all of their parents' belongings and placed the house in Sacramento, California, on the market. Afterward, he had headed north. He'd considered Yahats as a place where he could stop and think, a layover for where he was going to go next. With the disappearance of Carly Tate, and then Jenny Ackerley, he knew he wouldn't be going anywhere else, at least not until he found out what had happened to them. He never left anything undone, and he had promised Jenny he would bring Carly home. Now he felt like he owed it to Jenny. Rolling over, he wrapped his arm around the golden fur ball that was now snoring. A chuckle escaped him. He would have preferred a different warm body in bed next to him on his birthday, but as a second choice, it was better than a cold pillow, he decided. Scratching the pup's belly, he released a huge yawn and felt the last of the tension leave his body.
"Good night, Charlie Brown," he whispered in the dark, as his mind finally shut down enough for sleep to overtake him.
Chapter 3 4 months later.
"Not now, Charlie," Mike muttered.
Taking the ball Charlie had dropped on the case documents he was reviewing, Mike tossed it across the living room. He ignored Charlie's happy bark and the sound of the dog's nails against his newly installed tile flooring. Leaning forward, he turned over the paper he had just reread for the 100th time and began reading the next page.
"Come on, talk to me. Where are you? What happened to you?" he said in frustration.
He turned another page. He knew it was stupid to talk to a couple of pictures, but he didn't care. It wasn't as if anyone could hear him, except for Charlie. He leaned back on the couch and ran a tired hand through his hair. He'd been staring at the damn file for over 2 hours. He wanted to blame it on Agent Tanaka's call late yesterday afternoon. He'd put the case file away for the last couple of months. Now it was back out of the file drawer and nagging at him again. Tanaka said he was just checking in to see if Mike had discovered anything new.
"No, I have not discovered any evidence of aliens, mermaids, Bigfoot, or Santa Claus summer residence," he had grunted into the phone. Tanaka had not been amused.
The sound of silence, followed by a stiff thank you, had pulled another groan from Mike. Yesterday had been a very trying day. Two teens had taken one of the yachts for a joyride. There had been a fender bender at the grocery store, and Charlie had watered Patty's fake fern tree in the front office again. He'd spent almost an hour washing it off and hoped it would dry before Monday so that Patty wouldn't notice anything amiss with her prized $5 yard sale decoration. Life was easier when Patty was in the office. At least she could help keep Charlie entertained and out of mischief for more than 5 minutes. Deciding he'd endured enough for the day, he had rounded up Charlie and headed home.
"Damn it, Charlie, I said—"
Mike started to say before he snapped his mouth closed. Charlie had trotted over and dropped the purple squeaky ball on the papers scattered across the coffee table. The pup whined and placed his chin on Mike's knee. He chuckled at the pitiful look. Reaching over, he scratched Charlie behind the ear, earning a tail wag.
"I guess you were as tired of being cooped up as I am. How about we combine work and play, boy? We could go for a run and do a little field duty," Mike suggested.
Mike fell back against the back of the couch when Charlie enthusiastically agreed. Two large paws and a long tongue told Mike he'd better hurry if he was going to save the papers from being scattered across the living room floor after Charlie's hairy tail cleared off most of them on the first swipe. Pushing Charlie off of his lap, Mike stood up and began collecting all the papers. He picked up one of the fallen pictures from under the coffee table. Standing straight, he studied the photograph. Carly Tate and Jenny Ackerley's smiling faces stared back at him. A strange sense of calm swept through him. It was almost as if the two women were telling him that everything would be all right. He shook his head at the crazy thought that the women were trying to talk to him. He was losing his freaking mind. Gazing down at Charlie, Mike decided he needed some fresh air as much as the dog did. He bent over and stacked the rest of the papers and photos together and closed the file. He looked at the calendar hanging on the wall. Today marked the 1-year anniversary of Jenny's disappearance. Shaking his head, he slid the file into a large envelope. He could always take it with him and go through it at the scene where both women's cars were found. Maybe some fresh air, a little exercise, and being on the scene would make something click. It wasn't as if he had anything more pressing to do. He had the entire weekend off. Hell, if nothing else, he thought, watching Charlie hopping up and down off the couch in excitement, I can try to wear Charlie out a little so I can get some work done.
Grabbing his jacket and Charlie's leash off the coat rack near the front door, he pulled the door open. Charlie pushed by him, making